This is a good one. This is a deep cut. The number one characteristic, and this is true of both people and companies, is just like intense, relentless curiosity. People's trajectory is all about triangulation, collecting multiple data points. It's so funny to me that we get to this point where we're at technologically, and we say, religion and all this, it's so stupid. Like, we know all this stuff now. Have I created memories and artifacts that I review later that force me to change my behavior and change who I am or what I'm doing?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Kyle Harrison. Kyle is a general partner at Contrary Capital, as well as a writer. We talk about hype cycles, talent vortexes, investing in people, battles between tradition and progress, building systems, writing, and much more. Please enjoy. What's one question or problem that's been consuming a lot of your attention recently or kind of running in the background?
So I think, I mean, there's a lot of people in tech and in venture that are spending a lot of time thinking about AI, both for positives and negatives and, you know, the impact that it can have on people's jobs that may be dangerous and the awesome implications for what it can have for the, you know, technology, what can be built, what we can do with it and stuff. I have been spending a lot more time thinking about it, maybe less so, you know, certainly we're making AI investments and I'm excited about certain companies. But I am fascinated by the like ever increasing pace of FOMO cycles, and spending a lot of time thinking about, like, I still remember, you know, like was 2017, maybe 2017, 2018, like micro mobility was a huge thing and scooter companies were raising a ton of money and there were investors even branding themselves and saying, my career will be built on being a micro mobility investor. And it's like, that's crazy. And you know, none of those companies have proven to be very good companies. And it's like, why, how can we, like, as humans, in particular sort of investors and entrepreneurs, why are we so drawn to something and to the tune of billions of dollars of capital invested and, you know, life's worth of work for a certain years of time, at least, right? Like, to these things that do not produce the results that we want. And at the same time, like, I think micromobility as a concept and a construct can be valuable. And there are still people that get value out of having scooters on streets, right? But like the mismatch of like the companies and the way they get built and the opportunity that exists, the same thing kind of happened in crypto and Web3, creator economy, and now AI. But the fear that I have with that is I never want to be seen as like a skeptic, because skeptics in venture are not great to have. Like, you need to be optimistic to believe that any of this stuff can work out, right? When statistically everything's against you. So I'm not trying to be skeptical of the technology because I think AI is powerful. I also think that cryptography and Web3 and blockchain can be very powerful, and creator economy is real. And there are people who are building their livelihood off of just being creators. Like, I'm not skeptical of those things. I'm skeptical of the mismatch between the companies that get built and the way that we build them and the like intense fervor. I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I don't have a good answer for it, but it takes up a fair bit of my thinking and writing.
How does that inform your current investment philosophy? How do you, understanding that VC is a game of asymmetric returns and you want to find those outliers, you don't want to miss the boat, but also you don't want to get caught into a wave of what will eventually be defunct companies. How do you toe that line?
There are probably three things that immediately come to mind that I kind of keep in mind. The first is, and this is something I think Fred Wilson said recently at the Primary Ventures event in New York, where he said, investing behind hype cycles is probably the worst way to make money. So we actively try and avoid hype cycles. Again, we have investments in companies that are either AI companies or tooling for AI. We have an investment in a company called Nomic that helps to fine tune large language models. And so we have investments in this space. We're actively avoiding the things that feel like sort of hyped. It's like, even if it's a good company, you know, a good company at a bad price is a bad investment, right? So the first thing is trying to avoid getting caught up in investing in hype cycles, which means that we probably make fewer AI investments than a lot of people are making right now. And the second thing is I spend a lot of time thinking about the sort of, what do you have to believe? And margin compression was always a part of the equation, where you say, what do you have to believe if I invest in a company at seed stage? for it to be a massive company, what do you have to believe? And there's all these operational and strategic things that have to go right in the company's life. But there's also the, what does this company eventually look like? Does it, is it acquired? Is it a public company? And if it is a public company, how does it trade? Like all of those things were part of the equation. I think that often we lose sight of that because we think about, there's like a risk adjusted, what do you have to believe? And it's like, what do you have to believe? But what is also the statistical likelihood of what you believe coming true? And if you have to believe a thing that has a very low statistical likelihood of being true, that's a, it should become harder for you to believe. And for a lot of people, that isn't the case. But I spend a lot of time thinking about, for this company, what are all the variables that I have to believe for this to be a good outcome for us? And then the third thing I think a lot about is I look for companies that have some capacity to exist independent of the capital life cycle. And I have been thinking about that a lot more, obviously, lately. But one of the things I don't know that I ever articulated, and I have not yet articulated this in writing, and I would like to, because I think a few people have said some good things about it. But this idea of like a value chain of capital where seed investors don't just make investments in what they think are good companies. They make investments in what they think Series A investors will think good companies are. Mm. And Series A investors make investments in companies that they think Series B investors will think are good companies. And you have to have an understanding of what the next person will want to buy. Otherwise, that company will struggle to raise. And if their model is dependent on future capital, then they will suffer. And I don't know that anybody has fully appreciated how impactful that is, but it's the same thing as like in public markets, they say, you're not trying to guess what will happen in the market. You're basically trying to guess what other people think will happen in the market, because that's going to have more impact. Like that determines markets, right? So that's another area where I think about, are there companies that like, yes, they may need more capital, but I'm trying to find companies that will not be forever dependent on massive amounts of capital and massive outcomes.
Explicit within the name Contrary, you and the fund or the firm are thinking differently than other venture capital firms. What would you say are the key ways in which you're thinking differently? What are your core competencies that maybe other funds don't have?
I think there are two big things that set us apart, and some of them may feel like obvious, but every time somebody says like, yeah, I believe that, or I get that, I sort of ask them to prove it, like point to other firms and what they do and how does that demonstrate their belief. And it's sort of the actions speak louder than words thing. And you'll find that a lot of firms do not operate with these beliefs. So the first one is this idea that every company is simply a collection of people. And so Contrary is at its core people centric, and everybody says like, of course we invest in founders first and blah, blah, blah. But everybody's entire product and business model is built around a company and a transaction. Like there's this company and we invest in this round into that company. And that is 95%+ of our interaction with that company is we invest in that round and we support them as a Series B investor or as a seed investor. That's our role, is that transaction to that company. For us, Contrary has built multiple different, we think of them almost like product SKUs. We have built multiple product SKUs that exist completely independent of a company. So the first one is our venture partner program, where we try to identify the sharpest people in undergrad, grad school, PhD programs, whatever. And as they sort of begin their journey into the world of startups, we want to be right there with them, helping them understand the ecosystem that they're going into. And we specifically focus on finding people who someday want to be founders. But our venture partners program is meant to be a way for us to build relationships with really sharp people as early as possible, even sometimes years before they start a company. And that is a thing that we dedicate significant effort and time to that is independent of a company. Our content is the same way. We have, as of right now, we have about three major content lines, where one is Contrary Research, where we try and tell the story of private tech companies. One is Foundations and Frontiers, where we go very deep into specific areas of technology, whether it is, you know, nuclear energy or AI or whatever. And then the second is How We Work. And it is an interview series to dive deep into areas that, you know, most often technologists build technology for themselves because that's what they're exposed to, is other engineers. And we want to expose people to very different industries. So we've interviewed commercial airline pilots and tunnel engineers and stuff like that, right? if you think about it, all of those content pieces, they're not necessarily targeted at specific companies. It's not just content to say, here's how to run your company, which is what a lot of VCs do, because again, it's very company centric. For us, it's very people centric. So it's helping people understand private companies, or it's helping people understand areas of technology or different industries or whatever. So that first core belief is that companies are made up of people, and we do that in every product that we launch and build. The second thing that is very important to us, and that I write a lot about in my own personal writing, is the idea that I think every venture capital firm should have to justify their own existence. I think that we've had too long of venture firms being able to exist just because. And I think that every venture firm needs to be able to answer the question of what job should a founder hire your money to do? Mm-hmm. And if your answer is anything, then you're probably not a very good venture firm. Like, you are trying to be everything to everyone, which makes you good at nothing. Like, you're good at no specific thing for someone, right? And so we think very much about trying to be a product-led venture fund, not in the way that like we have an AI chatbot that we type in and it says yes or no, should you invest, but like product-led in the sense that like our content represents product SKUs. Our programs represent product SKUs. We're trying to have very deliberate products so that we can say, hey, these people, we can help them with these products. If you're not in this sort of target market that we've delineated with our products, that's totally fine. We're maybe not as good of a fit for you, and that's okay.
If I tried to distill your core vision or philosophy down into one statement, I think it's that you're trying to find talented people sooner and through more ways than VC has historically done it. And that's because you believe this is the next wave of venture capital. How do you retain this competitive advantage, this moat that you've started to develop as more funds realize this, and I'm sure they are, and attempt to copy you? Is it a function of the network you will have developed or something else? I'm sure it's a number of things.
Yeah. I end up quoting Clayton Christensen a lot. I really like him. He's a he's kind of in the BYU, you know, mafia node, whatever, alumni. So I'm a big fan of his. I've already kind of quoted Jobs to Be Done, right? Is this idea of like, what job do you hire a VC's capital to do? The sort of innovator's dilemma that I think exists in venture is this idea that like your job is to identify good investments and make those good investments. And it's this like company centric model that I'm kind of crapping on a little bit. That is the golden goose of venture capital, is it's just investing companies and, you know, whatever. I think that that worked for a long time because the like startup ecosystem and the sort of process of company creation was still very nascent for a very long time, and distribution and sort of the barriers to entry for those startups were very significant and like difficult to overcome. So things like having to rack your own servers and come up with distribution mechanisms that were very complicated, and even like on-prem software and stuff like that. All those things were really difficult. And so you, as a company, you needed to look to VCs to do that. The best thing that's happened to technology and to startups in the last 10 years has been that basically all of those barriers have been dramatically limited. Is that like cloud computing has made everything so much easier. Mobile has made everything so much easier. AI is going to make it even easier. Social media and content and sort of PLG and all those things have made distribution so much easier. So it's lowered all those barriers. And so when people start to ask, what firms do I want to work with? Whose capital do I want to take? It is by and large going to come down to who do I have the best relationship with? And as a venture firm, there is this sort of innovator's dilemma where they're stuck with their golden goose of saying our engine is around, you know, the identifying and investing in companies. Our end like outcome is still the same. We're also trying to identify and invest in great companies, but we're recognizing that things are changing and that we have to effectively like reinvent our focus so that we are building those relationships well in advance of a company to be in a sort of advantaged place in the future. And for a long time, that looks kind of stupid because we're spending a lot of time with fairly young people who are nowhere close to starting a company. And I joke that in the firms that I've been in the past, we would always play the sort of hurry up and wait game where it's like, I can invite you to a dinner once a month, but other than that, like until you start a company, there's not much I can do for you. For us, it's like, there are as many things that we can do for you before you start a company as there are things that we can do for you once you start a company. And increasingly, we will do things for you after you have exited a company. Like there's, we want to be relevant throughout someone's life, not just for their company.
I think one of the ideas or the theme running through what you just said is that finances have become a bit of a commodity, and now you have to find other ways to differentiate yourself and deliver value to founders. On that note, I've heard repeatedly something along those lines from a number of people. I had Emmett Shear on a few episodes ago. He said something similar, which is that the biggest bottleneck or constraint in startups isn't the money, it's founders. It's world-class capable founders. So to go one to N levels deeper, why don't we have more world-class capable founders? What's the constraint?
In my mind, so the first thing that is true is that founders, like being a founder, is a sort of dangerous catch-all title, in the same way that most like identity politics or whatever, like to say like this is a Republican, this is a Democrat, whatever. It's like those are too broad sweeping of terms to be that helpful to unpack. Mm. Being a founder is the same way. It's dangerous to say like a founder is this and it's not this. And it's like, well, a founder is a ton of very different things. Like, it's not a 19-year-old dropout, but it's also not a 45-year-old former exec, previous MBA. Like, they don't have to be both of those things. They can be all of those things or different things or whatever. So I think it's important to recognize that the sort of founder journey can come from a lot of different directions. But in terms of like the people who have the capabilities to build a successful business, I agree with that, right? Is that there is that limitation on those types of people. I think that the couple of things that come to mind that limit that supply chain, if you will, number one is a very unhealthy societal construct for risk. And I think that like the one way that I see that portrayed is you look at, you know, investment banking, consulting, like there's these sort of jobs that are very secure. And people want security and optionality. Like as a college student, you talk to a lot of college students, and the number one thing that they want, it has very little to do with like fulfillment, creativity, whatever. And it has a lot to do with security and optionality in the future, which is not necessarily bad, right? Like there's a lot of reasons why you should, just from a financial perspective, there's a lot of people that should, you know, build in that sort of career stability and stuff like that. So I don't want to crap on people who go do investment banking or consulting, but that is a mentality that a lot of people have, is that I want security and optionality. And I think that there is an element of like burning the boats and like chips on shoulders that most exceptional founders have. Not to say that, you know, there's no founder that's ever done banking or consulting. There's plenty, but I think it more comes down to the mentality and less the like specific path they have to chart. Right. And it is finding people that feel like there is this chip on their shoulder. And to respond to that, they have to burn the boats and they have to pursue this thing fairly dogmatically. And I think that is one of the reasons why you see so many exceptional founders come from immigrant backgrounds, is because they have a very different relationship with risk than most people do that have had a fairly secure sort of upbringing. So I think that sort of dichotomy is very complex. And I think there are ways that we could improve that and sort of improve people's or young people's relationship with risk taking. And then the second thing, I think that from like a training perspective, I think that the loudest lessons are often the worst lessons, right? Like it's for something to be broadly disseminated, it has to be very generalized and watered down to right. The point of like invalidity. And so people learn lessons that are most easily broadcast. And I think those are kind of the wrong lessons. And I think what that means is like people look for what they feel like a good startup should be. Like they look for an idea, they look for a market that like should be a good market. And it kind of goes back to the sort of Peter Thielism where he talks about competition is stupid. Competition is stupid because if there is competition, then by definition, you've not necessarily uncovered something unique. You're kind of going after a very tried and true thing, which creates a lot of like race to the bottom, you know, issues and stuff like that. And so I think the lesson that I would hope that people should take more of, and something that I feel like Paul Graham writes about quite a bit, is this pursuit of something that feels sort of meaningful and like concrete to you, like a problem that you know exists and that you want to solve. Which is, again, I think why some of the best founders are people who have lived the experience and are solving it for themselves. Like they're solving this problem for themselves, and it just happens to address the same problem for a lot of different people.
Right. one of the ideas that you've written and spoken about quite a bit that I really enjoyed is this idea of talent vortexes, which are individuals, mostly individuals, but there are also environments that just pull in other talent. PayPal Mafia is maybe the canonical example here. What are some of the consistent characteristics you found of individuals who form talent vortexes around them?
I think that the number one characteristic, and this is true of both people and companies, is just like intense, relentless curiosity. I think about this. So I've had a ton of conversations with younger people over the years, and I try and be very transparent where I'll say like, hey, like I'm an open book. I'll tell you anything. If you want to know like the, you know, inside baseball on this or why this is stupid, I'll tell you which companies I think suck and which people I've heard terrible things about and like anything that can help you in your career. I'm an open book. Like ask me any question. And they'll be like, well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I think that's all the questions that I, and I'm like, no, man, come on. Like anything, like I will break it down for you. Like what's the spicy stuff? Like, what are you trying to unpack? And they have the four or five, you know, career development questions that they wrote down. And they're like, I don't know what else to do, you know? I think the most intense sort of vortexes that bring interesting and talented people towards them, it is sort of the curiosity begets curiosity. Because when you meet somebody, if you're curious and you meet somebody and that person is curious, then the things that they are curious about pulls you into that sort of pull vortex to vortex to vortex, right? And that like multiple reality dissemination of seeing lots of different things, that's often what creates the most, both like most interesting people, but also the most well-equipped to innovate. Like you've been exposed to very different things, right? Like, you know, one of my best friends, like we don't have a ton in common. Like he buys funeral homes and rolls up funeral homes. Like he's in a very different world than I'm in, right? And he like collects like first edition books, famous books and stuff. And he has a boat and he talks a lot about sailing and stuff. But I feel like I learn almost more about venture and company building from him than I do from like the other person who looks and talks exactly like me, because he is thinking about the world in a very different way.
I think I already know the answer to this because of the way Contrary has assembled and the offerings that you have. But do you think we can actually manufacture more of these talent vortexes? And if so, how? What are the ingredients?
It's definitely, I don't like the word manufacture. I think maybe spark them, right? I think these are sort of more naturally occurring phenomena that you can't, they're not made in bottles. You can't, there's no MBA case study, right? They'll tell you how to create a talent vortex. But I think that there are certain ingredients that you can combine to spark this sort of environment. And I think the number one thing that I struggle to know how else to push this, is just kind of ambition. Like, I think that there needs to be a level of ambition. And I think there's a lot of like negative sort of implications that people feel around ambition. And I think that comes from like societal injustices, which are totally fair. Like people feel like they are sort of burdened by the weight of a system that doesn't work for them. And so ambition feels like a dirty word because it's saying like, oh, if you could just be as privileged as I am, like that, you know. So I think there's a lot of like negative feelings about that and like work-life balance and like mental health. And there's all these things that have made ambition feel kind of dirty. And I wrote a piece a couple of months ago called The Renaissance of Rise and Grind. And I think that there is a lot of like negative sort of, you know, grind mentality of like work for work's sake. But I think there is a level of healthy ambition. Paul Graham wrote a piece about great work, a similar idea of like accomplishing something that you feel very proud of and has impact on the world in a way that you feel is meaningful and positive. It doesn't always have to be saving the world. Impacting the world is okay. Like culture is created from having an impact regardless of salvation, right? Like it's not always that you're saving the world from the problems that it's created. It's that you're having a positive impact on the world that changes the direction of the way people think, whatever. And I think that ambition attracts the most sort of like very healthy groups of people that come together to want to pursue similar ambition. So the more ambition you have, the more opportunities there are for talent vortexes. So I think ambition is certainly number one. And then I think number two, I think that there is a limitation of like the like early hacker vibes that kind of made like Silicon Valley what it is. I think that people don't hack on stuff as often as they will. And the thing that I actually like about AI, who wrote this? Somebody said this. I don't remember. I'll have to look it up, but somebody wrote and they talked about, I mentioned this in one of my pieces and I can't remember who said it, but they talk about how in AI, oh, it was Venkatesh Rao, I think, wrote this, mm-hmm. where he talked about in AI, what is interesting is that for the first time, there is this sort of like wave, but most of the people talking about the wave are talking about it as like outside spectators and they're not participants. And I actually really like that. And I like that about AI. There were elements of crypto that I liked about this too, is there was a lot of people doing like deep research and firms like, even like firms like Paradigm and Andreessen were launching research arms to get into the weeds on this stuff. Like I like that conceptually. And in AI, I think there's a lot of people that are just hacking on stuff and they're just trying to figure crap out. And I really like that. And I think that in like broader application software and even in consumer, there is much less hacking, right? Like I liked Lower Carbon yesterday, I think, released a new fund announcement. And they kind of made, it's like almost like a joke, like that it was the early copy of the announcement. And it was like, they accidentally launched it to their WordPress and they can't take it down. And they don't, and it's like all these like, you know, saying the quiet part out loud of why they're not doing this and that, whatever. I just really liked it. And it was like very like, I don't know, you know, almost like web 1.0 jokes. But like, there's not that much of that vibe in consumer and software and whatever. And AI is sort of this area where there are a lot of hackers where it's like the hot stuff is happening, not in like, you know, VC conference rooms. It's happening in like random Discord servers and stuff.
As you continue to grow the Contrary network, how do you maintain a high bar for talent, for new nodes in the network? And I think it was either Bezos or somebody else at Amazon who said, our next hire always has to be better than the average of our current company, or else we're dragging the average and therefore the company downward. How do you maintain a high bar for talent and attract those people?
The first thing you have to know is that people's trajectory is all about triangulation. When you have two data points, you might think that you understand the slope of a person's career. It is all about collecting multiple data points. So the first thing is about, you want to collect as many data points as possible to understand people in different capacities. And I think this is true not only in identifying talent, but also in like marriage. Like the best advice I got before I got married was, you should try and see the person you think you want to marry. You should try and see them when they're sick, early in the morning, super late at night, on a road trip, right? Like lifting heavy things, everything, right? As much as you can to try and understand them in different contexts. And I think that that is true of talent as well, is that you should try and create lots of different touch points. And so that's what we do with Contrary, is that all of our products represent different touch points. We not only hope that those touch points create positive affinity with that person for us as a firm, but it also allows us to learn every event that somebody goes to, every piece of content they engage with, every, you know, whatever, every referral they make to us. It tells us like, oh, interesting, let's look at the quality of this person they've referred to us. And what does that say about them? And there's all of these touch points. So the first one is, it's all about triangulation, gather as many data points as you can on someone before you pass judgment. And so we try and have sort of a relevant high bar, and then for the person, right? Because it's like, if you try and apply a high bar for like PhDs to like undergrads, you're never going to take an undergrad potentially. And so you want to have relevant bars at the beginning and then collect lots of data points over time. The second thing is willingness to some extent, like curate or admit that you were wrong. That can go both ways, whether that is someone that we sort of wrote off early on where we said, you know, they worked on this project and it was really crappy, and that's a negative data point. Let's not worry about them. Or you can look at somebody and say, that was really, they did some really great stuff, and then they do some stuff and you're like, well, I'm not sure about that, but like, look at all the things they've done, right? It's just constantly being willing to admit that you're wrong, or that your perspective on someone can change and kind of evolve over time, and make sure that you are paying attention to that and understanding why you think highly of someone or why you don't think highly of someone, and being willing to admit that that thing has changed over time.
As a father of three and a member of the LDS Church, I imagine you spend a fair amount of time thinking about what's quote unquote good for humanity. Have you found that doing what's profitable for the fund is sometimes at odds with what's good for humanity? And if so, how do you navigate those competing incentives?
There are definitely, everyone has a very different opinion on how they sort of measure their life. So somebody texted me just recently, a really good guy, super interested in climate tech and being able to have, impact on climate change and things like that. And he texted me to say, like, I don't want to put money into the stock market. I don't want to make money just doing this or that. Like, I want, how do I dedicate all of my time, talent, money, energy, whatever, to just fighting what I see as this, the most important crisis, this climate crisis? How do I do that? And I don't have a very good answer for him, but I feel like for the thing I tried to articulate from like my perspective is that I think that for everyone, there is this element of like, sort of circle of influence and circle of control, kind of a Stephen Coveyism, right? And I think that by increasing your profitability, your size, your influence, whatever, you also increase the size of your control. So the bigger you are, the more impact that you can have. And there are a lot of people, I have really good friends who are, they're totally dedicated to, they just want to make the world a better place. And they're, I mean, they're almost, you know, monastic, like monks, right? Like in the way that they like are totally limited in what they do and they, whatever the impact that they have, but they, and that's great. And within their very small circle of influence, they are seen super positively, but they have a very small circle of control and they have very little impact on the broader world. And so I think that by focusing on things that are profitable, that can help you increase your size and your influence and stuff like that, that increases your ability to go do, have a positive impact, do the right thing. Right.
Right.
I think there's two barriers to that. There's two limiting function on either side. On the one hand, I think that there is a sort of means justify the end, fallacy that you can fall into where you can say like, I just have to do whatever. I screw whoever and do whatever. It doesn't matter if it's dishonest. I'm just trying to get big so I can make the world a better place and blah, blah, blah. That is, I think that is false. I think that you have to live with everything that you do and you have to be very cognizant of like what your personal bar is and what your personal moral compass is. And probably one of the most dangerous things is this idea of like, do whatever you want, just don't hurt anybody is very dangerous because like, what is that? Who does that leave you to hurt? Just you. And that's very dangerous. And so I think you have to be very thoughtful of what your actions measure up to, number one. And number two, I think there are a lot of people that I knew who were maybe too far in the opposite extreme where they were like, I'm going to make as much freaking money as possible. And then I will do good. And then I will be a good dad. And then I will donate to charity. And then I will whatever. And philanthropy is a muscle that is learned and developed. It is not a switch that you flip on or off. And if you spend a lifetime gathering assets, you will not have the muscle to be able to distribute those assets very effectively, for the most part, I think. And I look at, I'd say somebody like Warren Buffett, and it's like, I don't know that he's the most like philanthropic dude ever, right? Like he hasn't, his life wouldn't demonstrate, like, it's like, what are the things he's made the most money for? And it's like candy and sugar drinks, right? and Apple, which is a great investment. But maybe human rights violations, right? Like it's nothing about what he has done has been like philanthropic right. per se, but he's basically getting to the end of his life and he's saying, I'm going to give all of it away. But when you look at the first principles of a lot of what he's done, I think that there are things you could say of like, he has not been incredibly selfish in the way that he's done. He's aligned incentives perfectly to try and say, if I build Berkshire Hathaway, I'm going to get enriched the same as you, rather than trying to charge as many fees as humanly possible. Right. So I think that there is an element of like, he's still building that muscle over time that made him comfortable doing what he's going to do.
In the same vein or in an adjacent idea space, how do you reconcile tradition or religion or this kind of anchoring in the past with your day job, which is all about progress and innovation and moving forward? How do you balance those two things? Or do you actually find that they in some ways complement one another?
So I personally don't have any conflict or contradiction that I see in like religion, science, technology, whatever. I think it is all a matter of like the scope with which you peruse the problem. And I think that there are elements of reality, scientific reality today, that if you demonstrate it to somebody who is operating within a scientific paradigm from 1,000 years ago, would absolutely be fall to your knees, worship the magic levels of insanity, that they couldn't understand. They don't have the construct to understand it. And now it's so funny to me that we get to this point where we're at technologically and we say, you know, religion and all this, it's so stupid. Like we know all this stuff now. And it's like, I was reading a thing recently that was, you know, dark matter and dark energy, right? Collectively, they make up whatever, like 40%+ of the universe. And we don't have a clue what they are, right? Like we don't have any sense of what they are. And we're going to be like, we've got it figured out, you know, like those idiots from 1,000 years ago, they don't have any idea, but we know all the things. And it's like, I am willing to acknowledge that I don't know all of the things. Like I'm still trying to figure out a lot of the things that I have heard that are outside of the realm of the provable today, make me feel better about the construct of the universe that we live in. But you know, as a religious person, like there is this sort of Jesus specifically had one, you know, rule basically that he laid out where it was love God with all your heart, might, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Like those are the two things. And people get really caught up in the like love God thing, cause they think it's like, oh, there's this magic being that we have to like worship, and what did he do to deserve it? And I think it's more about like, we're supposed to have this like, analogy to learn from, like this characteristic, these attributes to learn from, to make us better. And if you really love yourself, you will want to become better. And then if you're loving your neighbor as yourself, and your neighbor is literally everybody. And there's this comedian who jokes about, he's like, right, but like, what if they like invade where we're living? And it's like, love everybody. And it's like, right, but what if they look different than us? And it's like, seriously, like love everybody. Like what? I don't know what's so hard about this. And like, I can boil it down to those simple principles of truth of like, those make the universe feel better to me, and how I raise my kids and how I think about the world is. And so when I think about science and technology and why I get excited about investing in it is because I see that as a way to grow closer to God. Because if God is a sort of creator, we are also trying to create things. There is a spark of creativity in every human being. And it is part of that looking up to this analogy of creativity, this the most creative being in the universe. We are trying to be more like that. And so creating new things and solving problems, that's part of that.
Well said. Shifting gears slightly and maybe bringing the venture and investing part of the conversation to a close. You have this line that I'll probably butcher in one of your articles that says something to the effect of, your blog is called Investing 101 2.0. I think the 2.0 is implicit. Because you want to understand the foundations of investing or the history of it and where it's going. And so I wanted to ask, this is a two-part question. What was true a generation ago in VC but is now outdated? And what do you think is true today that will be outdated a decade from now?
Well, first of all, you're calling into question maybe the worst branding decision that I've ever made, because everybody I talk to hates that name. and so I usually refer to it just as Investing 101, because I'm still probably figuring out the basics. You know, I've got time to figure out the 2.0. But yeah, that is originally my sort of hypothesis in writing and why I named it that. It was this idea of like, what are these foundational principles and how can you understand better those foundational principles by sort of reinventing the future? And your question is a really good one, because it's basically like, we can crack on all the first principles of venture, and whichever ones break and allow us to move forward,
right,
those are the things that were never first principles to begin with. And so those aren't 101. Like the reinvention of those things means that they were not fundamental. So it's a really good question. And like it makes me feel good that not everybody hates the name of my blog.
No, I love it.
So when I think about like what was true 100 years ago, I think that the like first principles, I often come back to this idea of like capital allocation as an exercise. Like there is this idea that capital fundamentally, there is this sort of very core unchanging economic model that capital can be allocated to maximize itself or to minimize itself, right? Like that is the equation that we're all operating on. And I think that the first principle that a lot of people have lost sight of, but is still fundamentally true, is that a dollar is a dollar is a dollar, and a dollar can be allocated in different directions. And the impact of that dollar needs to be quantified in a few different ways, but the maximization of that capital needs to be one of them. You need to act. That's why I go back to this idea of like justifying why you exist. And there are a lot of firms that economically don't make very much sense. Like they haven't generated, you know, maybe they generated a few returns in a certain way or certain companies, but they haven't consistently built an engine that maximizes that capital. And they try and get away from that, but no matter how hard you get away from that, at the end of the day, you're allocating capital and you need to be held responsible for the impact of your capital. One of the things that I like, and this was one of the things, like I had a really hard time with impact investing, which I did some of in my early in my investing career and never really liked, because I always felt like we were saying, well, it's not good. It's not a good allocation of capital, but it's not too bad. And like, look at the positive that we're having, right? And the thing that broke me is like, I looked at like how difficult it actually is to allocate capital altruistically. It's really hard to not have a negative social impact. And so a lot of impact funds have actually had more negative social impact than positive. And so one of the lines that I really like is Chris Sacca at Lower Carbon, where he talks about, I think in a podcast, it was like a 20 VC podcast. He talks about, he's like, I'm going to get way richer doing this than I ever did investing in tech companies. Like I want the greediest son of a gun who doesn't give a crap about ESG or the planet or greenery or whatever. I just want this guy who wants to come in and make absolutely as much freaking money as possible. I want to make that guy money, because if I can make that guy money, if I can get that guy to buy in, I can get anybody to buy in. Any of the people who also want to have a positive impact can see that guy making a ton of money. That's the goal. Like at the end of the day, the goal is to be able to maximize capital. I think that there are negative externalities that haven't been sort of applied to some elements of technology, right? You could argue that like we should have to net all of the capital that people made off of Facebook off of any negative implications from that technology. There's a lot of, you know, fuzzy area there of like, how do you quantify,
right?
You know, those sort of like non-capital outcomes or whatever. But so when I think about the thing that is true, it is that fundamental principle of like, our job is still always about identifying ways to maximize capital. The thing that I think has changed and is going to set up the sort of next wave of, you know, things that are happening, I think a big part of that is, the sort of, I might butcher this. I've been wanting to write a piece about this for a while and I haven't ever gotten around to articulating it very well, but it is effectively
a good forum for testing out the language.
Exactly. It is effectively like the modularity of people and resources is it's more disconnected than it has ever been before. So historically, the only way to build an organization or a company or whatever was around packaging resources and people into these like very concrete things. And now you look at the like unbundling of that. And some of that is like we talked about earlier, where it's like, you know, cloud computing and AI code assistance and, you know, whatever, no code tools and social media and stuff like that. A lot of those things to some extent unpack the components of a business. But I also look at things like Mr. Beast, and like how a very small group of people has been able to accomplish a significant amount of value creation, just in terms of like attention gathering is the game. And then now he talks about like, it gets to the point where, you know, his videos get so many views that most brands can't afford placements in his videos, because it's like a Super Bowl ad and not everybody has the budget to do a Super Bowl ad all the time. And so that's one of the reasons why he's launched things like Feastables, which is like a candy bar, because it's like, well, if I can then use my own value to drive more value to my own products, then it justifies not paying, you know, not getting an advertiser or whatever. And so again, it comes back to this idea of like, there is still a core first principle where he has capital or a resource and he's allocating it effectively. Like that is still a first principle thing that's happening. But what is unique is that he doesn't necessarily need, he has a lot of other ancillary businesses and things they do and stuff. But like within the core business of creating videos and value creation and stuff, he doesn't need the same like consolidation of hundreds of people working in one company doing one thing and,
right,
you know, working in departments and stuff like that. It's a very decentralized thing, but he's still able to be you know, the Mr. Beast franchise, if you will, is a multi-billion dollar organization, like based on the value they've created. And I think that meaningfully in the future, there could be billion dollar, like companies that are valued at $1 billion, generate hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue, and have maybe one person working with them, especially with like AI agents and stuff like that, that will eventually become more capable for them. And so that sort of decoupling, or like having these modules of people and resources, that is very different. And I don't know how that will play out. And I don't know how venture works as well in that model. Cause like, if you have one person, what costs do you have that you really need a significant amount of capital? And more people are talking about like, how do we invest in people as opposed to entities and stuff? And I think those things could have actual implications for how businesses get built and how capital gets allocated.
That's fascinating. It's very interesting to think about. Do you consider yourself a writer who invests or an investor who writes?
I go back again to this idea, and maybe this is like a boring economics way of thinking about things. I consider myself an allocator. My day job is allocating capital. Like, I am an investor in that way. But to my kids, I'm an allocator of time and attention. To my audience, I'm an allocator of words, right? I try and think of myself as like a finite pool of resources, and I try and measure myself on how am I allocating those things. Even like spiritually, I think of myself as like, I have a finite amount of discipleship that I can allocate to God, and how well am I doing at allocating that? And it's like, not that much. I'm way more of a disciple to my phone than I am to God sometimes. Right. So there's a lot of these pockets of resources that I have as an individual that I'm allocating, and some of them I'm allocating better than others. But if I had to define like how I think about myself in a uniform, you know, identity, it is kind of that allocator. Cause I'm also like always judgmental of myself, of like, I'm not doing a very good job allocating my attention right now with my wife in this relationship or in this conversation or whatever. So that is constantly how I am evaluating my own, like evaluating myself and defining my own identity.
Do you find that you've written elsewhere and talked elsewhere about how you have these systems for taking notes, for measuring and reporting on your progress in all of those areas you just mentioned? Do you find that having too many of these systems and these kind of rigid ways of looking at your inputs and outputs takes some of the joy and presence and like organicness of life away?
I would not.
Or net, it's positive.
Yeah, I wouldn't consider myself a, there are, I don't know, like words or phrases that people use, but like, I'll just say like a maximalist, I guess, like a productivity maximalist, maybe is a good way to say it. Mm-hmm. I do not consider myself one of those. There are people who measure like everything they eat, everything they do every day, every minute of their day. And there have been times in my life, like I have used like a time log so I use Rome Research every day for my note taking for different things. I used to keep a time log at the bottom where I literally like check my watch and be like, all right, at 11:01, I got up to go to the bathroom. Then 11:03, I started checking my emails, and I try to keep track of every minute of my day. And that worked a little bit like in my work day. It never worked in my personal life. And so I've sort of kind of given up on the like productivity maximalism. I think instead, like, my systems are more about, have I created like memories and artifacts that I review later that force me to change my behavior and change who I am or what I'm doing. And if I do that, I've done a good job. Like, my systems have worked. If I look back at a journal entry, if I look back at a photo I've taken, if I look back at a video diary, like my family and I occasionally will do like video journals together where we talk about, you know, how things are going and stuff. If I look back at the, or even just my notes, like if I use my note and my sort of my relationship with Rome Research is probably the most poignant thing of like, it's constant. Like, I'm constantly reviewing notes that I've taken, thoughts that I've had, quotes that I've read, things that I've, you know, looked at, and reflecting on them and having that impact the direction that my brain goes. I consider those success. But like since COVID started, for example, like I don't read as much as I used to. Like I was probably, when I had a commute before COVID, I was probably reading, you know, 40-ish books a year. And now I read like maybe 11 or 12. And like four or five of those are like Brandon Sanderson audiobooks. So I read, work out, right? Like, so I'm not reading nearly as much as I used to. And so my engine for taking in information has had to change. Or else I don't feel as good about that particular system, and I would feel pressure to read more and stuff. But writing consistently is probably the reason that I'm okay with not reading as much, because I'm reading a ton of stuff for my writing. And so I feel okay about that engine. But if I wasn't writing and I wasn't reading, I would start to feel the pressure of I need to create a different system.
You have this quote that's pinned to the top of your Twitter profile. I think it's also in the about section of your blog. It's a Flannery O'Connor quote that says, "I write because I don't know what I think until I read what I say." And you also had this other quote that I think pairs nicely with that in one of your pieces that was, "Writing is a lagging indicator of observation." What do you feel like it is about writing in particular that allows you to flesh out or maybe even discover your thoughts on things that other mediums or processes aren't as good at?
So if you think about, if you've ever had the experience of like, you bend your body in a way and you're like, so like, for example, I have three kids, right? And so I'm frequently like bending backwards to like get into the back seat to hand them something or get something or whatever. And every once in a while, I'll like, it'll be just in such a way where I'm reaching under something, over something, around a door, around a car seat, whatever. And there's a tweak in my neck or something, right? And it's like, you know, I realize, or like a muscle that is just getting stretched that I haven't felt or whatever. And you realize like, because I'm moving every day. I'm using my body every day. I'm moving around every day. Like I'm doing stuff every day. And yet that muscle or that motion or that thing has never happened to me to feel that feeling that I'm feeling. And like, that's so weird, right? Like I have this body with me all day. That muscle, I didn't just add it. Like it's come with me everywhere, every day, but I didn't use it. Observation is, I think, another one of those things that like we take for granted. We're like, you're observing stuff every day, all the time. Like you're intaking information. Your brain is processing information all the time. And if you don't stop to stretch your mind in a way that you maybe haven't stretched it, you may not even realize the observations that you have in your mind. There's this other thing that I kind of joke where I'll say like, there's a little bit of truth in every JK. And it's like, you made an observation and it was funny. And like, we all laughed, and like, we laughed because we kind of think the same thing. So like, you made a joke about me being ugly or whatever. And it's like, we all kind of think I'm a little bit ugly, right? Or else we wouldn't have laughed at that, right? Like if you make fun of Ryan Reynolds for being ugly, it's like, that's not a funny joke. Nobody would laugh at that because it's not true. We've made observations, right? And so I think like that act of like forcing yourself to like reflect on your own observations and inputs with an output is the only way that you realize like, man, I don't even know that I realize that. And I think actually like the only other way that I honestly more enjoy, maybe one of the reasons why I started a podcast as well, although like it's very different for contrary research, or like I like to do conversations like this. Like I've probably said, you know, a dozen things in this conversation already that I don't know that I've articulated it that way before, right? I don't know that I've said it exactly that way before. And so writing is probably my favorite common way that I create that output and reflect on my own observations. But like ranting with someone, you know, and jamming on stuff and like talking about stuff, that is probably my number one favorite way, is just to be like ranting on stuff. I just don't record it enough. And so that's why I try and do more podcasts, is because when I'm ranting with my friends at night, I'm not recording it. And who knows how many awesome things like we've lost by not recording our conversations.
They're all complementary and feed into that same system that ultimately has that output you were talking about.
Yeah.
Have you found that you write because you've intentionally developed a habit, or because it's a compulsive need, so something you just have to do in order to clarify and get out your thinking?
This goes back to the productivity maximalism. I have tried at times to have systems that like force me into doing something. And almost always when I have those systems fail me. mostly I fail my systems, right? But like I, you know, the human frailty and stuff like that. And so often if you have too many goals, it's too difficult to do a bunch of different things. And so you just give up on the whole bag. And so when I started writing, I technically started writing sort of middle to end of 2021 and then started publishing in 22. But when I started publishing in 22, at the beginning of 2022, I was like, all right, I'm going to fail if I try and create all these intricate systems. Like I have to do these things and I have to have a rundown and I have to have an interview. I have to do whatever. And so I was like, I'm going to set one goal. And that goal is that I want to publish something on my Substack every week without fail. I want to never miss a week. And I kind of took this from, so Jerry Seinfeld has this, I call it Seinfeld's calendar. I don't know if you've heard this before, but he says, your job as a comedian, you have one job as a comedian. Your job is to get a calendar, put it up on the wall and write jokes. And every day that you write jokes, you cross out the day. And your only job is to build as long a chain of unbroken X's as you possibly can without ever missing a day. That's it. That's your only job. It's just write jokes, write jokes, write jokes, write jokes. And so I kind of thought about it the same way, is like, if I want to write, what's the one thing that I need to do if I want to write? And it's like, well, it's just to write. Like, it's not about writing quality. It's not about writing a certain content. It's not about writing whatever. And so I said, all right, I just want to write. And so this past week was my 89th week without missing a week. Many of them are not good, right? Some of them have been like, I'm driving and I'm about to lose service on a camping trip. And I'm like, technically on my phone, writing up a Substack post to say, like, search the word grass in my Substack. And usually that's like, touch some grass, return to grass. Like, that's me being like, I'm going to go touch some grass. So sorry, this week sucks. Like, that's me trying to maintain that goal, even though I'm not doing very good at it. So some are better than others. But I think that just that one goal of, I just don't want to miss a week, is the thing that has made it really powerful for me.
Just a few more questions. There was another quote in one of your pieces that really stuck out to me that I was hoping you could elaborate on. You said that people think they're, and I quote, too busy to take advantage of great opportunities, but we should instead let opportunities survive for as long as possible and then take advantage of the best things that stick around. Can you elaborate on that and why you think, if I'm interpreting this correctly, that we should only take those opportunities that we think will have longevity, will still be there in years' time, as opposed to the ones that feel like they're only immediately available?
This is a good one. This is a deep cut, because I don't think most people have read the piece that this quote is from. If I'm remembering correctly, maybe I'm remembering, but I talk about this concept a lot of like the natural selection of time. And it's this idea that I've returned to a couple times, but the sort of, like, I try and pay attention to like core experiences in my life. I in my personal website, I refer to it as like my music. And so it's like, when I was on my mission, so I started mission for my church for 2 years, and I tried to pay attention to like the best lessons that I learned. And they were encapsulated usually by a memory. Like, I had an experience and I encapsulated it with a phrase or a sentence or a quote or whatever. And so that's my music. And then when I left college, I did the same thing. And my first job, I did the same thing and whatever. I try and pay attention to these like core concepts that make up how I think about the world. And I refer to them as my music. And one of the things in my music is this idea of the natural selection of time. And it came from when I was in college. I had two experiences that I kind of mapped together. One was, I had the opportunity to do an internship at, Mitt Romney's family office, to work with them. I was trying to build my experience in investing. And I, as most BYU people do, I really like Mitt Romney. And so 10 years ago now. And so I was interviewing for this internship opportunity to go to Boston and work in this family office. And I was, at the time, I was in Africa with my second startup. And I really wanted to do this internship. And I was like, and they offered it to me and I agreed. And I was like, let's do it. And then I went to tell my wife, and my wife said, I have one class to graduate and it was only offered this semester. And if I don't, I have to wait a whole year. And by then you might have gotten another job and moved. We have to move. Then I can't. And it's like, my number one thing is, it is important to me to finish my degree, and I can't finish my degree if I don't do this class, and I have to stay here. And so we considered like, she maybe stay in Utah and finish her class, and I'd go to Boston. And we didn't like that. We were newly married. And so I called him and I said, I'm so sorry, like, my wife's situation, but please, like, I'd love to keep in touch. I'd love to try and do something else. And so then the semester passed and I got another job offer. Like, this family office was just to be an experience, never a full-time job. I got another job offer that could lead to a full-time job. And they called me to say, hey, how about this semester? And I said, I am so sorry. I just got this job that I can't say no to it. Like it could be my full-time job that I take. I'm so sorry, but please can we keep in touch? Like, I'd love to find a way to work together. And they said, yeah, no worries. And so while I was at this internship, they called me and said, all right, how about this semester? And I said, well, let's do it. And I went to Boston and it was great. And I loved the people that I met there and I learned a ton. And I would credit some of what I learned in that experience, sort of charting my path into venture and why I did what I did and why I focused on what I focused on and all these different things. And so I allowed that experience to survive. I would counter that with like experience that I had where while I was in undergrad, I worked. So a seed fund in Utah called Kickstart Seed Fund. They had this, it was basically a student run venture fund called Campus Founders Fund. So I was on Campus Founders Fund. We would invest 10 to 20K checks into student run companies at different schools in Utah. And so I'd been doing this for about a year and I was helping to recruit. And I was looking on LinkedIn for people in Utah at different schools that had interesting backgrounds, whatever. And I was messaging them on LinkedIn to say, hey, we're recruiting for this thing. It's a great experience. It's been life-changing for me. It's been my kind of introduction into venture or whatever. And like, I can't tell you the dozens of times people just said, hey, sorry, I just have a busy semester. And like, no follow-up, no, like, let's keep in touch, whatever. Just like, sorry, too busy. And it's like, okay, I'm not going to message you again, like whatever. And there was this one woman who responded and she said, I'm super busy, but I would love to do this. Is there any way we could figure out a way to do this? And that woman now is work. She was not in any way kind of headed into like venture and startups. She was doing something totally different, looking at consulting and finance and whatever. And she kept that opportunity alive with me and engaged and was on that in that program and stuff. And now she works full time as an investor at Kickstart Seed Fund, doing seed investing in Utah. She's amazing.
Awesome.
And that experience happened because she allowed that interaction with me to stay alive. So I've kind of been on both sides of the keeping an opportunity alive table. And I try and apply that to life. Like, I think there is a sort of burning the boats mentality of like, you can't constantly be trying to keep your optionality open. But I think that if you don't have to kill something, then why kill it? Like, maintain the conversation, like try and keep those conversations open, because you never know when something good might arise down the road.
I know you're a fan of Bezos's idea of minimizing regret, or using regret minimization as this barometer for success or satisfaction in life, or as your compass. What regrets are you trying to minimize, whether in your personal life or career?
Hands down, without a doubt, the number one thing that I am most terrified of is getting to the latter years of my life and my wife and I don't have a relationship. We barely talk to each other. Like, we've, you know, stuck around because of the kids or whatever. Like, we just have no relationship. Or like, my kids are so deeply uninterested in me, like, just don't care. Don't really engage. Like, I am their dad by genetics alone, basically, you know. Those are my biggest fears, is like, nothing will make up for that. Like, nothing will. I could make billions of dollars, and if I don't have those relationships with the people that I love the most, none of that's going to matter. Like, that's not going to help me feel better to sort of drown my sorrows in my billions, like Scrooge McDuck, right? Like, my number one priority is making sure that I have a meaningful relationship with my wife and my kids, and trying to find mechanisms to be able to do that. And I probably the hardest on myself about when I fail at that, right? When I'm too angry at my kids, or I'm not present enough for my family or whatever. Like, those are absolutely my biggest sort of feared, presupposed regrets.
Both of those resonate and are things I think about on a weekly basis. In closing, I ask the same question to every guest, which is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Oh, interesting. I think that the question that has helped me the most, like in my life, and kind of reflect on myself and things like that. I think it all comes back again a little bit to this like allocation idea that I have of like who we are, right? And I don't know. So like, the question would be, it's fairly simple. If you could go back a year from now, 5 years from now, or go back a year previously, 5 years previously, 10 years previously, and know what you know now in that moment, what would you do? And most people are like, buy Bitcoin or whatever, you know, buy Amazon stock, whatever. And it's like, all right, focus up. Like, what are the things in your life that you might change or do differently? And then, and maybe it is buy Amazon stock, right? And it's like, okay, now fast forward back to today. What are the Amazon stocks or the Bitcoins? Or what are the, I wish I hadn't passed up that job? Or what are the, you know, I wish I had never gotten in business with that person? What are the those of today? Because you can't change the past, but you can learn from the past and you can impact your future. And so go back in time. What would you change? And then identify the same things that you're going through today that you can impact that hopefully will have a more positive impact income for you in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever.
Excellent. Kyle, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed reading your work and in preparation for this. And then, of course, the conversation was excellent as well. So yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Spencer. This was super fun. I appreciate it.